Welcome to the Digital Academy of Behavioral Economics podcast, where we delve into the fascinating world of behavioral design. Leading our journey is Gerhard Fehr, a distinguished delegate of the Fehr Advice and Partners Board. Fehr Advice is a leading consultancy specializing in behavioral economics, creating sustainable business solutions through evidence-based insights into human behavior. Gerhard, an applied behavioral economist and behavioral designer, is renowned for his innovative approach to solving complex problems. In each episode, he invites a diverse array of guests from the fields of science and business to engage in thought-provoking conversations that bridge theory and practice. With a personal mission to inspire and foster an experimental mindset in business and politics, Gerhard creates a platform for exploration and discovery. Prepare to be enlightened and inspired.
Welcome to Uncover Blind Spots, the podcast of the Digital Academy of Behavioral Economics that sheds light on the mysteries of, could say, behavioral economics and shows how it can improve the world. I'm Gerhard Fehr. Today we have a very special guest who will offer us a profound insight into the world of economics, but not only economics. One of the hottest topics that we have is climate change, so we are able to combine these two issues. I'm honored to introduce Professor Stefania Stancheva, a renowned professor at Harvard University, whose work in public economics and policy design has significantly impacted our understanding of taxation, redistribution, and now the critical issue of climate change and policy responses. Her latest research, Fighting Climate Change, an International Attitude Toward Climate Policies, co-authored with an impressive team, provides a deep dive into a global perception of climate change and the effectiveness of various policies aimed at combating it. So, Stefania, my first question to you, tell us a little bit more about your life and how you entered the world of economics, behavioral economics. This would be very interesting for our users.
Wonderful. And thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really delighted to be here. I actually started my interest in economics relatively early on before I even knew what economics really was. And that's because I was born in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. I then lived for a little bit in Eastern Germany before moving to France. And so throughout my childhood, there were a lot of economic discussions going on about inflation, about the exchange rate, about disparities and inequalities that I found really fascinating and that I wanted to understand better. And it's only later that I understood there's a field called economics that could potentially shed light on these questions. And so I didn't hesitate much. And I really knew that this is what I wanted to study. And definitely no regrets on that choice. I still find it very fascinating.
And this was when you were 14, or it was the beginning of the university, or when did this start, this interest in this kind of macroeconomic discussions?
Actually, much earlier, because I have many memories going back, for instance, in the summers to Bulgaria and witnessing, for instance, the hyperinflation of 96, or pegging the exchange rate because it was so volatile. Mm-hmm. So these were like daily discussions, which of course I did not understand. And to be frank, I don't think we have a super clear understanding of all these forces even today. But yes, it was something that was truly fascinating at that time already. And witnessing the huge disparities between, for instance, Eastern Germany and Western Germany, or the big inequalities, in the Parisian area, where I then grew up. All this was just really fascinating to me earlier on.
And then you talking a little bit about your curriculum to study economics, or what have you exactly then? What was your way to economics?
Yeah, so I was I started at Cambridge University in the UK, where it's a 3-year program in economics, and I was super lucky to actually get an exchange year at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston, which was truly eye-opening to me because it's a place which is extremely extremely at the forefront of research, and students actually do get involved in the research of faculty if you want to. And that was really eye-opening on the world of research that I knew less. Mm-hmm. And that was very clear at that point that I wanted to to do a PhD in economics. So I first completed a master program back in France and then joined the PhD program at MIT.
And have there been some specific, let's say, personalities or scientists in those days who thought, hey, this is quite interesting what they do and also the methodology they follow? Or was it just a clear understanding of the field of economics that was aiming to you?
Mm-hmm. I think people are always extremely important. And I try to keep that in mind always now when I talk to students and I interact with students now. So there were definitely people who were very inspiring and gave me also a lot of support. It started with Esther Duflo at MIT. So I was very interested in development economics at that time. Continued with my incredible advisors, then Jim Poterba, who's still at MIT, Van Verning, and then one of my co-authors, Emmanuel Saez, who is also very influential in helping me think about lots of issues in public economics. And I've overall been extremely lucky to meet lots of people through the years in France, in the US, that have been extremely supportive. And I think that's where a lot of ideas and inspiration comes from.
Who influenced you most, if you could put this?
I think that's hard to say because I think all these people very much contributed. And I would say today, even, you know, colleagues that are around me, you know, at the department, you know, that you get to speak to regularly, that's, you know, these serendipitous moments where some ideas emerge, some connections emerge. I was very lucky to be just down the corridor from Alberto Alesina, who sadly passed away 3 years ago, but was an incredible, incredible researcher in person. And then our students are also, you know, so energetic, so enthusiastic about research that it's just a pleasure to talk and get, you know, joint ideas from these discussions.
Yeah, perfect. So if we come to your, it's not your latest, but I mean, you're writing on how many, in a similar way, you're writing on how many different papers now, if you could, is it four or five, or is it just one? No, I don't think so. Yeah. How many papers you're currently working on?
Oh, it's probably more than
10,
I should
15.
Count. let's just say too many at once.
Too many, But, this is the normal answer of a scientist.
Yes, because it's as you know, first we have a lot of interests and a lot of questions that I want to answer. But also, you never know how long something takes when you start it, and so. There's definitely too much, but they're all very interesting. And one thing I'm focused a lot on is my lab, which is called the Social Economics Lab at Harvard, which is destined to try to understand, you know, people's reasoning, people's understanding, people's perceptions about important public policies and about the economy overall. And the way we do this is with large-scale surveys, which really help us get into people's minds and see things which are otherwise invisible, like reasoning, beliefs, understanding. And so that's something I'm really, really passionate about at the moment.
Okay. And I think this was also the reason why when did you start to really interested in this topic of climate change? Because it's a hot topic since 15 years, but your recent paper, Fighting Climate Change, has been, I think it was, you made it public 2 or 3 years ago, I think.
That's
when
right.
did this start?
Yes, it started around 4 or 5 years ago when sort of, you know, this became a topic that I think first is hard to ignore as a person. And then as an economist is truly, you know, truly fascinating because there are so many economics elements in it, but also political economy. And I thought it's a topic where we actually lack evidence on, you know, how citizens think about this and what constraints are, what their concerns are. And so this was the goal of this project.
So, and if you could, by simplifying a little bit the issue, how could we summarize it in a way that you say this complex issue of climate change for our audience and why it is so difficult to tackle?
Yes, absolutely. This is essentially one of the puzzles that we start from, which is that climate change is a very pressing and urgent issue. And if you, at a very high level, look at people's concerns about it, people's worries about it, you see that many, many people across the world today are very worried about it. Yet it's very difficult to implement policies definitely at a national level, and of course, even more complicated at a global level. But even at the national level, there's a lack of consensus on what should be done. And so what we're asking here is, where is the problem really? What is the key obstacle to climate action? Is it lack of knowledge about, you know, what climate change is, what it will do? Is it concerns about who will pay for it and what is it going to do to my budget and my lifestyle? Is it broader concerns about the economy? Or is it simply a misunderstanding of the policies and what could potentially be out there? And so these are the questions we try to drill into in this project.
And I mean, there are a lot of open questions. And I mean, then you, I mean, in your social lab, you're doing large surveys. And I mean, the whole paper is also a lot of data in it. And if you look at it, you have done a lot of surveys, I think, to drill down more or less these questions and get answers out of this. Maybe you can really let our participants a little bit know, how does this go? Yeah, it is really, because yes, this scientific work, yeah, because science is, for a lot of people, is so, they say, invisible. And we talk about, oh, this is only theory. But when I look at your work and I look what you do, this is not theory. You're really practical, working on the issues and collecting data and so on. Maybe you can give us an impression about how this is. And it's teamwork, I suppose.
Absolutely. It's definitely teamwork. So the goal is definitely to be practical here. So in this case, in this project, we try to survey people in 20 countries. So the goal is to cover different countries with different experiences, but the focus is on countries that emit CO2. So it's covering the 18 largest emitters in the world. And the way these surveys work is we design them very carefully and think of them as really detailed drill downs into a thought process, into how people think, rather than just, let's say, a superficial poll, like, you know, do you support this or not? So it's at a much deeper level. So we design them and then we adapt them to each country so that they're, you know, in tune with what people might understand or with the cultural subtleties in each country, mm-hmm. translate them properly. And all these surveys typically contain an experimental component too. So what does that mean? It means that in this case, there will, for instance, be three different videos that will be mm-hmm. informative videos. They will explain something. And we will randomly draw which people will see each of the videos, and one group will see no video at all. And so because we will select people randomly who will see it or not, we can say this, you know, the answers we then see after people have seen the videos, they reflect the effect of that information that we have provided.
It's not only an observation. It's not only an observation, yeah. It's just more than an observation. It's that we can really say this is causing the future answers they give, for example, in the survey. Is it like this?
Exactly. And think of it, you know, like medicine does these experiments, mm-hmm. right, where one group gets a drug, another group might get a placebo pill, exactly. And then you can look at the outcomes. And because the initial partition was randomly selected, that allows us to say, okay, this will actually be the effect of that information. And in our case, the effects we're interested in is the effects on policy views. So what type of policies people then support after getting additional information. And some of the key findings that we have here, you know, we try to really say what determines support or opposition to mm-hmm. climate policies. And it turns out it's three factors that matter mostly. And some of them are super intuitive. And you might say, okay, that's clear. And others less intuitive. So one thing that's very obvious that matters is self-interest, which is, will the policy hurt my household? So for instance, people who are lower income or who are more reliant on polluting energies, who live in rural areas where there's very little means to substitute away from polluting, like transportation, for instance, those people are understandably just overall less supportive of climate action. Mm-hmm. And this, you could put all this into the category of, you know, your own self-interest. The other thing that very much matters is, do you believe in the effectiveness of a specific policy in reducing emissions? And this might sound obvious, but it's actually quite hard to understand. You know, if I tell you, let's put a 5% tax on, you know, vehicle fuels, mm-hmm. the effect of that on, you know, first emissions, then like temperatures, and then climate change is hard to understand, right? Even for climate scientists. And so people will have very different beliefs about how effective given policies will be to actually...
So whether it doesn't work and it's just a tax to...
Exactly.
It works a lot or it works wrongly and has side effects. Is it like this?
Exactly. So for instance, is that even going to do anything to temperatures, or is it just going to, you know, tax people without much change in the temperature? And so people have different beliefs about that, and that very much matters. And then the third thing, which is more surprising perhaps, is people have a very strong equity concern or equality concern, if you want. There's a very strong perception that many climate policies are regressive, which means they tend to disproportionately hurt lower income households.
And so they're not fair.
They're not fair in a sense, exactly. The burden is not fairly split. There is a sense that higher income people are just not bearing, you know, a sufficient amount of the burden to pay for climate change. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very strong equity concern. So some policies are considered more equitable than others, and these will be the policies that will have much more support. And I'll tell you a bit more, you know, very concretely, some examples. Yeah. But what's interesting in this list of factors that matter is also what's not in there. So for instance, worries about climate change or how concerned you are is not very predictive of your policy views. And the reason is that many people are already very worried. So it is no longer something that will necessarily determine your policy views.
Meaning, are we talking about, because we always, in maybe before I read your paper, and I thought that not so many people are worried. So my beliefs about, I'm very worried, yeah? My beliefs about other people's beliefs, yeah? Was very, very low. And I thought, I was just observing that they're not changing their behavior. But there is not, it's not what you would say that they are very worried. But maybe there are a lot of people that think that other people are not so worried that they are worried. Or maybe you can elaborate a little bit on this.
Yes, no, that's a very important point because... I think it's a commonly held view, and this might be because in the past, there must have been much more dispersion in how worried people were. But I think now that time has passed, that a lot of, you know, disasters have happened, that a lot of places are actually viscerally seeing the effects of climate change, that social media allows for like info to circulate and seeing, you know, floods that happen here, wildfires that happen there. I think there's an overall big increase in awareness. And so, today, the state of the world is that a lot of people are very concerned. In fact, the concerns, you can correlate them with how exposed people are themselves, you know, whether they have witnessed recent climate events, whether there's been like visible pollution around them, things like that. But overall, you know, people have, I think, adapted to this view that there is a lot of potentially bad consequences. But you're saying, you know, we don't see people change their behavior. And I think that's a very, very important point because... We are very clear to distinguish in the paper between your private actions. So, you know, do you recycle? Do you switch to a different energy? Do you switch to an electric car? Which is essentially, what are you individually willing to do given current policies, given current incentives? And these things vary a lot. And here it's especially higher income people who are just able to do these given current prices, given current incentives.
Okay.
And many people say they would like to do things, but it's just not financially feasible for them.
Affordable, yeah.
Yes. And that's very different from your wish to see policy action, right? Which is a systemic action that will come together, you know, either with taxes or subsidies, help for adjusting, etc. So your policy views to me are very different, you know, a very different thing. And these two are correlated, but not one for one. So, and I think that's very understandable. And so we really hear, you know, when I'm telling you, for instance, there's a big equity concern, this is about policies. And so when you look at what doesn't matter, it's basically concerns about climate change because they're already so widespread, or specific knowledge, you know, about exactly which industries pollute or, you know, which gases cause temperature rises, et cetera, that's not very important. So it's really the effectiveness concern, your self-interest, and this equity concern.
Okay. And if you look at all these three factors, or the three arguments that the people have, is they are complementary, meaning they are supporting each other. If you are, or are they just that you have a segment of people that have a self-interest and that you have a segment of people that think it's not fair and so on? Or they're really, let's say, complementary factors?
So they're complementary to some extent, but there's not, you know, perfectly. So there's definitely variation in people, where many people will, for instance, think, you know, this policy is potentially effective, but it's also very unfair. So there's just variation across people and across groups. And, you know, as a result, what you see is, just to draw a few key policy implications here, you know, thinking about, for instance, carbon taxes and perhaps more generally environmental taxes. Across many countries, they're quite unpopular. And it's not that they're not perceived to be effective. Overall, people think they're quite effective, but people think they're very unfair. So they tend to think it will really hit lower income people. And you can change that by asking people about different uses of the revenues from that tax.
Exactly.
So should the revenues go, you know, for equal transfers back to everyone? Should it be targeted transfers to low income or vulnerable households? Should it go to environmental purposes or be put back into the general revenue of the government? And you see very clearly the support is much, much higher when it goes to more progressive uses. So for instance, helping low income people. And also when it's especially earmarked to environmental causes, like it's going to be used to, like, you know, help invest in new technologies, help households get new equipment so that they can better, you know, adapt. And so this has very clear policy implications, I think, where the taxes are quite unpopular when people think it's just going to go back to general revenues and be used, you know, the way other taxes might be. So that's one, I think, very first important conclusion. Another thing that comes out, which, you know, sometimes it's puzzling to economists, is the fact that people might, in some cases, prefer outright regulation rather than taxation. So, you know, as economists, we think it's in many cases more efficient to tax something. For instance, let's tax polluting cars. But people think it's actually, in many cases, more fair to outright ban polluting cars. And the reason here is exactly this equity concern, which is, there's this notion that it's unfair that some people can continue to pay to pollute.
To use and,
Yeah, exactly. And it's considered more fair if everybody's sort of subject to the same, you know, same prohibition here. It's not always the case, but it happens and it's a bit puzzling to us, but this equity concern can explain this.
Yeah, and you look at all three, can we say if a measure is more or less perceived as very equitable, and it is perceived as, let's say effective, and it's perceived as it's not touching my self-interest mainly. Yeah, for example, that I have to pay, but I get it back when I am part of a low-income segment. Then it's a very high probability that people will support this kind of measures, first of all, and also change their behavior. Could we summarize it like that?
Exactly right. And, you know, many policies are currently not like this, but could in principle, you know, be adapted. So, for instance, either on the use of the revenues when it's a tax policy, or, you know, changing the modalities of a regulation when it's a regulation. And so, you know, one thing that's clear is, like, to help with the self-interest concern, it's really important to give people the means to substitute. What I mean by this is, you know, if I tax an activity that you're doing, but you have no other choice, then I'm not going to yield any change in your behavior, right? I'm just going to essentially penalize you. On the other hand, if I give you a means to substitute, for instance, there is better public transportation available, or you do get potential help to get to an electric vehicle and there's electric charging stations. These are like ways that give you the option to substitute, and then you'll be actually able to change your behavior when there's a tax.
Coming to the worries, I mean, can you elaborate a little bit on how, because a lot of our users or participants have not read more or less the paper, how many people are, because my belief was it's about 50-60% maybe I have worries. But on what level are we? It's a big variance between the countries. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this.
Yes, absolutely. So across these 20 countries, I mean, the sort of minimum concern, like the share of people who will say climate change is an important problem, the minimum is, you know, around 70-75% of respondents. And that's actually in the US, in the United States. In places like Italy, in Korea, in many developing countries, the concern is much, much higher. So really around the 90% of people will say that. But everywhere it's, you know, at least 3/4 of people say climate change is a really important, serious problem.
So, I mean, coming back to this, we see that one side of the puzzle, the people are worried. Yeah, we have, this is more or less, we have to have action. On the other side, what your papers tell us is it's a matter of policy design, meaning that we need some policy principles in order to, let's say, get the measures. And the third part, and you're a behavioral economist, then test it. And this is not in your paper now, but do you have any ideas about whether public or the politicians today are have the willingness to test this kind of measures? Is there experimentation something which is maybe also much more popular than we think it is, or less popular than we think it is? Maybe you have here some research.
What I know is that there's a lot of interest in these results and in this type of research. And I personally am more involved in policy making in France. So I do write, you know, reports and suggestions in the Council of Economic Advisors there. And we did write a very concrete note about what this suggests for, you know, policy actions and policy steps. And I think it was very well received. Experimenting in real is quite tough. And in that sense, having this actually this sort of survey tool is very useful to be able to, you know, ask people about different scenarios and how they might react, how they might think about it. It's like a way to test it, you know, without incurring the very costly action of necessarily putting a tax in place, you know, and having to backtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an extremely useful, I think, policy tool as well as a research tool.
So it's a laboratory experiment in the beginning, but then there come the time you have to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I think is the climate change is such a big issue, and we have this one factor which means effectiveness. And this is something where laboratory experiments can give some evidence about effectiveness, but real-life experiments could, let's say, if they are made small-scale maybe in different areas and be really supported, be on the one side quite interesting for science for sure, but to really make it credible, the effectiveness, and show that the politics is working on the right issues, this could help and support. And what is your view on this?
I think that's very true. And there is, I think, more and more experimentation by various governments. In the US, it is a common thing for maybe, you know, 30 years now, actually, with smaller scale social programs. And you know, it's typically led by researchers, but supported by either cities or states altogether. And so I think this has been quite important. For instance, on the one important policy here, which is the earned income tax credit, which is essentially an in-work subsidy to help low-income earners. There's been lots of experiments with it. How to design it, how to give information to people, how to coach them perhaps to like find a job. So I think experimentation is going on, and now it's also led even by private firms. And so I think it's going to become more and more common. And I see it, you know, in Europe too. I think there's willingness, you know, on a small scale to experiment with things.
This is my last question now about your paper. If you say, okay, for our participants, what we, first of all, the future is bright when I read your paper, because we have some solution in there, how to tackle the issues. But besides this, what are the three takeouts for our participants out of your academic research, which makes them believe that the future is bright?
Yes, that's a great question. I think the first, you know, the future is bright, you know, in moderation, because this will still have to be implemented and taken to heart. But I think the reasons to be optimistic is first that we understand a bit better now what's like a key obstacle. And the key obstacle, you know, in terms of people's equity concern, I think is is possible to think about seriously. I gave examples with how to use the revenues from a tax or how to design regulation. The other thing that there's a reason to be optimistic is, yes, of course, you know, people care about their own household and budget, and there's lots of ways to make that easier on them. For instance, you know, what's done right now in many EU countries is to announce a tax that will happen in the future, but give people time and actually give them extra help in the form of subsidies or transfers to adjust to that. So for instance, be able to switch the equipment at home, be able to change their heating system, etc. So giving that time is a way to address the, you know, the self-interest. And the third reason to be optimistic is that we actually see in this experiment that information does work when it's information about how policies are, how they function, who will be the winners and losers, how they can be compensated. So information that addresses people's concern is actually quite effective. And so that's a reason, I think, to also push for a better, like, you know, for lack of a better word, a better economic education in a sense, that should be done by a nonpartisan organization and in each country to help people grasp exactly what proposed policies will do and how they will impact them.
Maybe we need some institution for climate change, like we have invented, economists have invented 150 years ago with central banks, where you see that politics is not able to tackle it, but is not able to solve it. And maybe this could be also, there's a new idea about this, that you need this neutral side on the problem. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. The last thing I'm always doing is a word wrap, Stefania. These are okay. 30 items that I would, and please tell me what of the following items do you like more? This is more an approach that our participants get to know you a little bit better beyond your academic style. So it's quite easy. It's about your preferences, and I will start now. It's coffee or tea?
Coffee.
It's book or movie?
Book.
It's city or countryside?
I'm sorry to say city.
It's early riser or night owl?
Early riser.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
Digital or analog?
It really depends. I'm very digital these days.
you have to. It's not. It's digital then. It's art or science?
Oof. Impossible to pick. My daily life is science, but I need art.
That's why it's art. Mountains or ocean?
Mountains.
Okay, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Okay, cats or dogs?
Oh, that's so tough. Impossible.
Okay. So then now we come a little bit more to instant gratification or delayed reward?
Oh, delayed reward.
Okay. Hyperbolic discounting or long-term goals?
Long-term goals.
Altruism or self-interest?
I hope altruism.
Yeah. Competition or cooperation?
I hope cooperation.
Okay. Risk-taking or risk-averse?
Risk-averse.
Loss aversion or risk-seeking?
Loss aversion.
Okay. Known probabilities or navigate the unknown?
I prefer known probabilities, but I always have to navigate the unknown in my work.
Rely on intuition or seek more information?
Seek more information.
It's now the last three. First impression or comprehensive analysis?
Comprehensive analysis.
Status quo or change seeker?
Change seeker.
Okay. More options or fewer choices?
More options.
Seek supporting evidence or challenge your beliefs?
Challenge beliefs.
Okay, perfect. So
these are fun.
This was very nice. Stefania, thank you for sharing your invaluable insights and research findings with us and with me. I always learn a lot, and it's been enlightening to understand the complexity of public attitudes towards climate change and the path forward in crafting effective policies. So, ladies and gentlemen, this was Stefania Stancheva on Uncover Blind Spots. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to follow us on our platforms and share your thoughts and experiences. Goodbye until next time, as we continue to explore and unveil the secrets of economics for a better world. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to our exploration of behavioral design with Gerhard Fehr. we've journeyed through the nexus of science and business, gaining insights and finding inspiration from innovation. Remember, every day offers a new opportunity to apply these principles and shape a better future. Until we meet again, keep experimenting, stay curious, and drive change. To stay up to date with our latest episodes, be sure to follow the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, consider sharing it with friends or on social media. See you in the next episode.